Hi, folks. I have the pleasure of being joined by Rupert Lowe MP, who is fresh off of his Tucker Carlson interview. So that was pretty big. How did that come about?
That was an interesting interview. I mean, I wouldn't say fresh, Carl. I've had a stinking cold. And as you can probably tell, hopefully my voice will last the course. I've got the Lemsip in the cup here ready to hopefully resuscitate it. They approached us, and I've always very much liked what Tucker Carlson does.
Hmm.
So we met in London, in a hotel in London. Got to know him a bit. I thought he was a very nice chap. Yeah, he does all sorts of things I like doing, like fishing. He's a very keen fisherman. He's a keen shot. Mm. he's a countryman. So look, I liked him very much, and we did a straight off the cuff interview, no preparation, talking about a range of things. And I think America is deeply concerned about what's going on here.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, and I told him and I appealed to him that we need help now from the USA. I mean, we need some proper logical thought from people who care about the Anglo-Saxon alliance and who want to see the libertarian fringe of the world unite and protect freedom and the way of life that we've all arguably, and we now take for granted.
So there's, I have a concern with this aspect and this angle, which is it allows the left to become xenophobic and claim patriotism. And I've already seen them trying to do this, saying the British right is wholly in hoc to the American right and dependent upon them. And therefore we are in some way foreign. Whereas, in fact, it's the left that is wholly dependent and in hoc to the Europeans and who are actually trying to impose a foreign ideology on us.
Well, I think what it is, it's the comparison, really, isn't it, between a malign ideology, which I think all these left-wingers carry with them, the Fabianism, the Pabloism, you know, the Haldane Society.
All of Blairism is
far less tolerant than we are. You know, I don't mind having a decent debate with people, even if they disagree with me, and I very much liked Tony Benn and I very much liked Peter Shaw and Old Labour. I thought they were good people. They're very honest people, but they had a different opinion to me. I don't like Jeremy Corbyn's politics, but at least he's clear about what his politics are. You know, when you've got most of the Labour Party being members of the Fabian Society, whose sort of emblem is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
No. Rupert, I've got to correct you. It used to be a wolf in sheep's clothing. They realized that it looked bad and they changed it a few years back. Wow. But yeah, no, that was the original logo.
They may have changed the emblem, but I don't think
they haven't changed the soul.
The agenda has changed at all.
Yeah.
So I despise those people. I despise Keir Starmer. I despise almost the entire front bench of the government. I think they're ill-equipped to be doing what they're doing. Whereas I think, you know, in Britain, in the old days, you had politicians whose interests were aligned with the British people.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably made a few quid out of it, and they probably positioned themselves and their families well. But actually, they delivered for the country. And I think you're seeing that a bit with Trump. So Trump has cut through all of it. I mean, he doesn't go into great detail, but he's got a sort of cunning way of summing it all up in a very simplistic way, which everybody can understand. And I think after years of what I call deceit, and I put the European Union in that, as you and I know, the EU's genesis was a post-war communist plan based on a monopoly, which was the European Coal and Steel Community. And I think it's always been living a lie. And I think the Democrats were the same in the US. So I think it's refreshing to see. And I don't talk about myself being right wing. I talk about myself having some common sense. And so I talk about uniting those people who've got common sense. And that's my plan.
Now, I you know, from everything I agree with there, I'm more worried about the strategy. Because I do think it's important that the British right doesn't appear to merely be a MAGA fan club, right? Now, I say this as someone who is, I've got many, many, many American friends who are, you know, influencers, politicians, and they, as you say, they are very concerned about the state of our country because they do look at us as the mother country. But there's a certain kind of prejudice in Britain against the Americans, not in a hostile way, but in a more sort of contemptuous way, perhaps, that we shouldn't be just directly following in their footsteps, that we should be charting our own course. And it's not that the left care about that, but they'll see it as a valid angle of attack on us if we appear to just be a tribute.
Well, I think a lot of that agenda, Carl, is driven by the BBC, which, as you know, mm-hmm. is a monopoly.
I agree.
And which, you know, I've listened to the garbage that's come out this morning post the tragedy on Bondi Beach. And, you know, they are institutionally biased towards Islamism.
They are.
And, you know, against the Jewish people. And I think...
Well, can I stop you there? Because they are, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm more talking about the dialectic of if we're...
No, but it comes from BBC. A lot of that agenda.
Hang on. I'm not certain that it does. That's the thing. A lot of it is actually... a lot of it comes from... It definitely comes from a certain kind of dialectical position in the left where they are looking for ways of drawing up a wall against our ability to pierce into the conversation. And if they can just dismiss us as Yank nonsense, which I think they will try and do, then we are kind of falling at the first hurdle. And it's not that I disagree with you either. We, you know, the American right are our close friends and they very much care about what's happening. But I do think optically we shouldn't be seen to be overly reliant on them or their methods. Because I do think the strength to recover the country is still within the country. I still think that we have it here.
Well, I agree. And I think, you know, if you want to go right back, then we played our cards very badly in the American War of Independence when we should have.
Oh, yeah.
When we should have effectively listened to the issues, and we could still have America as part of the family.
I think
they
it was
are
a,
part of the family, and so
I think
are,
it was an idea whose time had come, though.
No, so are New Zealand, so are Australia, so are Canada to some extent. Even if Trudeau was the most disastrous part of their history, So I think yes, but. I say the BBC because the BBC leads this thought process. They are infested with people who, I think, have got used to being in the bosom of a monopoly.
Oh, yeah.
And where I think the left, as you say, is a danger to what I call the sort of bedrock of decent Britain is I think they're a danger. They don't want strong communities. They don't want people who are independent-minded of independent means. What they want is a dependency culture which relies on their malign philosophies. And they've Brown and Blair laid a lot of the foundations for this dependency culture, which Labour see as, if you like, their nirvana. In the same way that they... I think a lot of the Islamism comes from the fact that they see the Islamic vote as their vote and that they see it as an important part of them winning elections. Well, I can tell them that the Islamic vote will migrate to Islamic members of parliament away from Labour. So it's only a matter of time before that happens.
For any of our foreign viewers, that's the Green Party in Britain.
Well, the Green Party, I mean, how is Zach Polanski taken seriously, Carl?
I don't know.
The guy is a total and utter joke. I mean, he talks drivel. None of what he says has any, doesn't have any sort of reality about it.
It doesn't describe anything.
It's what I call once upon a time, but unfortunately you're not going to live happily ever after if you listen to Zach Polanski.
Well, what I find interesting about Zach Polanski is he's tapped into the sort of true essence of what the left is, which is genuinely a series of almost like computer code, where you'll notice he's got very well scripted answers to any subject. that is designed to capture the average left winger and say, oh, right, this is the correct formulation of what we believe, whether it describes reality or not. And you'll notice that he's not really converting new people to his cause. He's just gathering the faithful into the Green Party. So I think their constituency is naturally limited. And frankly, I'm not really that worried about them. I actually think that let Zach Polanski become the totemic leftist in the country because everyone else is heading to the right. It's not going to save them. The Conservatives and the Labour Party are both heading right, but it's not going to save them. I think their time's done. I mean, to be honest with you, I think we might be looking at the last Labour government ever.
Actually. It's quite possible. I mean, the British people are always slow to turn, but I think there is a big change taking place. And I think there is a big reckoning for what I call the Reds and the Blues have done to Britain. The Reds, starting obviously with Tony Blair, laid the foundations for it.
I'd go back to the 60s.
And where the Blues went wrong is the Blues didn't, with an 80-seat majority, use the opportunity to repeal a lot of the malign legislation and actually return Britain to what it should be. I mean, obviously, it did have its roots in I think, particularly the post-war legislation, which I think decided that there should be more for everybody. And therefore, it was this post-war, like in Europe, it was here too. You had this sort of underlying vein of socialism, which I think everybody felt was, after the relief of winning the war, important to embed within society. So we got things that I think are now no longer sustainable. I mean, the National Health Service being one of them. I think, though, it's changing because in the end, you can't, communism showed you that you the collective always fails in the end. Because as I've said on many occasions, to survive in the USSR, you needed one quality above all else, and that was to be an extremely adept liar. Mm. So in the end, about 98% of the country were liars. Mm. And they still, I think, to some extent, have that legacy. And it sat there. But, if people have to lie to survive, then they learn to lie to survive. If people have to tell the truth to survive, they tell the truth to survive. So it's a question of how you program, how the elite program society. And I think the Labour elite wants a dependency culture. I don't. I want high-minded individuals who believe in themselves and believe in their family, believe in their community, and aren't frightened to say what they think needs to be done. So bravery plays a big part in it.
I think so. But you're completely correct, I think, of the dependency culture. This is basically the very end point of liberalism, where everyone is maximally dependent on the state, minimally dependent on one another, which is the opposite of what I think a proper society is, actually. I'm very much a fan of the AJP Taylor perspective that in 1915, the average Englishman could go his whole life without interacting with the state beyond the post office.
I love that, don't you? That's what you want.
It's the dream. It is the dream.
The state should be minimalist. And I actually, as I say, I've said it many times now, I think the state has got so big.
Oh, yeah.
It's become the enemy of the people.
Yeah.
What the state's lost sight of is it's supposed to be serving the people. Mm. And in a libertarian democracy, you need responsible people who do defend the realm, which clearly we're not doing now because we're allowing the enemies of the state to come here and do damage to us.
Yeah.
And you need obviously to collect some tax, and you do need a welfare network, although in Victorian Britain, as I've said on this program before, we had the friendly societies.
Yeah, it's done charity.
And human beings are actually, on the whole, good. The state's never good. The state doesn't have a conscience.
No.
Human beings have a conscience, and they do put in place the support networks that you must have for people who need help. But that doesn't mean people who sign themselves off with mental health for no reason and play the system, which we've now got on a huge scale. So
the problem is, I think a lot of the British public are actually emotionally wedded to the way our welfare system works. And I'm quite concerned. I mean, apparently it's 53% who are net withdrawers from the state rather than any net contributors, which is approaching levels of sort of South African levels.
Well, I look at the state now, Carl. So I'm on the Public Accounts Committee, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we see the state is not as accountable to the people as the people are to the state. So I see it correct. Every day now. So the DWP have had their accounts qualified for 37 consecutive years, right?
So what do you mean by qualified?
Well, their auditors have qualified them on the basis they don't reflect reality.
Oh, right.
Which we all know they don't.
Well, I didn't think they were, did I?
And then we've got 4% of local councils have had a proper audit.
Really?
All companies have to have an audit if they're over a certain size.
Yeah.
And signed off by the auditors, or the tax collectors, as I call them now, because the state has weaponized all of our advisors against us to collect tax.
Yes.
So, whereas they don't, and, you know, I've got a meeting later today about government advisors, and I suspect they don't know how much they spend on advisors. I don't know. I don't think they know which advisors they use. I think it's, you know, the whole thing is one rule for the state and one rule for the individual, which is why the private sector is declining and the state sector is growing. And Rachel Reeves, bless her, in her ignorance, thinks she can central plan a recovery, which she can't. The only way to get a recovery is to empower the private sector and grow the private sector. You know, and this is why I think we don't see a downturn, because in the old days, the state used to be 25% of GDP.
And was it now 45%?
That's more. I mean, probably directly over 50 and probably much higher if you take a lot of the indirect quangos and regulators and all the other rubbish that's built up.
Just a quick pause on that, sorry. People will find it hard to believe that the state is consuming about half of the British economy.
It's become the enemy of the individual.
People will honestly challenge you and say, are you sure about these numbers?
Yes, I am.
And I have to try and explain to them that the quangos spend something like £500 billion a year. The quangos alone.
Well, the regulators, look at the regulators. I mean,
it's an unbelievable
out of
amount
control.
Of money. And people, it's so
what,
large.
What was it Ronnie Reagan said? If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And when it stops moving, subsidize it. That's what he said.
But genuinely,
a man who could sum things up in a few short sentences.
He was just very funny as well.
Ronnie Reagan, what a man.
Yeah. But people genuinely, I think, don't understand the scale of the problem. Because the numbers, I mean, when you say 500 billion, what does that mean to the average person? Well, you know, if 1% of that was put into your bank account, you'd be fabulously wealthy forever. You wouldn't even know what you were doing with yourself. So it's numbers beyond scope. And so it's essentially meaningless to people. And I think that in the face of such a vast state apparatus, people kind of become helpless and they withdraw into themselves and just think, okay, well, I'll just let the government do whatever it's going to do.
Well, a society based on merit, everybody finds their own level and actually it's sustainable.
Yeah.
A society based on statism and central planning means that you get Napoleon the pigs at the top.
Yes.
Who basically it's a do as I say, not as I do culture.
Correct.
It's full of committees. And as we know, committees adopt the intellect of the lowest common denominator on the committee, the most manipulative, dishonest person on that committee.
The Labour Party member, yes.
Indeed. So, you know, I why can't we just release people, let them interface on merit, let them thrive, let them grow as people, let them grow intellectually, and not basically sort of reduce them to serfdom, which is what the socialists do.
Now, you're singing my tune, obviously. But the question, well, why can't we do that? And I think that there's an underlying element of fear to it, as in what you're proposing is scary to people who have, for the last 20 plus years, been habituated to believe that they should be dependents on government. And so the big selling point of the quangos, of the committees, of the excessive regulation is that, trust us, we will keep you safe, right? This is going to, you know, your life might be getting worse, but at least it's predictable that tomorrow will be much like today. And what you're offering them is unpredictability. Now, I am the sort of person who enjoys taking risks. I personally love unpredictability because you never know what happens. But a lot of people aren't that way. So how do you persuade them that this is a good thing for them?
Well, do you want to be run by the rainmakers and the risk takers, or do you want to be run by the risk-averse pork barrelers who are living off the state? I know which I'd rather have.
Well, I know what I'd rather, but a lot of people will say, oh, I don't know, I'm a bit nervous about all of this. And so I've been thinking about this, and I wonder if there's room for, like, I don't know, some sort of state-run charity or something so people could donate to it.
I think people have just got to get real, Carl. I mean, when Rachel Reeves says she's not going to tax working people, well, working people are a function of the people who employ them.
Yes.
So if you overtax the people who employ them, you are going to damage the interests of the working people. And I think a lot of people who work for family businesses and, you know, I think they're the lifeblood of Britain. I don't like these corporates. They're as almost as rotten as the state now. They're arms of the state.
Oh, yeah.
The people who run the companies don't own them anymore. They have a tiny shareholding.
Mm.
It's owned by faceless pension money. So there's no heart to those companies. So you get lots of injustice happening. Whereas in family businesses, like, you know, we have family businesses, they all know who owns the business. And if you behave badly, they're able to judge you.
Mm.
And quite rightly. And you know, those businesses lie at the heart of the community. If the businesses flourish, everybody else flourishes.
Yep.
If the businesses don't flourish, they don't employ people. And you're seeing, I think, a government that doesn't understand how this country has been built. It's not been built by central planners.
Mm.
It's been built by family businesses,
shopkeepers,
who are, you know, they identify trends, they risk their own capital, and in the end, they lubricate the growth of the economy, and through the growing economy, you end up with effectively a better society. You end up with more money for the arts. You end up with so the whole basis of it is to generate the wealth, and the Victorians, we owe a huge vote of thanks to the Victorians because they built up probably the greatest concentration of wealth that the world's ever seen because they were diligent, they worked hard, they were clever, they thought things through.
They were moral.
And I think a lot of the problems nowadays, and this is why Restore Britain, we're trying to do proper research on subjects that actually go into more depth than just a 20-minute conversation and a press conference the following day.
Yeah.
These are proper documents that look at the genesis of the issue. They look at how that can be solved and then how you can actually practically solve the sort of downstream effects of what's gone wrong. So,
well, can I pick you up on that? Because I think that obviously, as an Englishman, what you're describing just sounds like heaven to me, right? Yeah, I want, family-run businesses that, you know, dot the land and make everyone's lives better. Completely on board. But I wonder if the language of free markets is masking that. Because I think that what a lot of people hear when they hear sort of Reaganite or Thatcherite talking points on free markets is they're thinking about like BlackRock or international capital, which is able to buy up tracts of land and buy up businesses and shift them around the world and actually dislodge the local businesses from their own context.
But BlackRock and people are not the essence of capitalism. They're almost monopolistic.
I agree.
But they are actually dangerous because the people at the top of those organisations, I don't think their interests are entirely aligned with the British people.
Oh, I completely agree. But I think that's what people hear when they're hearing free market rhetoric now. And it's not that I disagree with free market rhetoric. It's just if I think a lot of these people perceive it as essentially having a country with no security against predatory international capital. And so is there a better way of communicating what you're saying that excludes what they are? Because I think that the
well, I don't think we've had capitalism for a very long time. So I think you've got to appreciate the fact that we've had, and I saw it when I was in the city when I was young, you had an establishment that was frightened of what they called systemic risk. Right. So they bailed the banks out when the banks made a mistake. We had long-term capital management in America got bailed out. Then we had the, you know, the 2000 glitch got bailed out. Yeah. Then we had 08 bailed out. And in 1987, Greenspan, actually, who was the biggest free marketeer, broke all of his own rules, and he closed the markets and intervened and saved Wall Street at the time from collapse. It was literally, I mean, I was in the dealing room. And so I think this has been going on really post-war. So I don't think we've had true capitalism for a very long time. And I think people have to accept that to come off the state's teat, as I call it, is not going to be a very comfortable time, because when you come off this delusional, call economics,
yes,
it takes a long time for real investment to take effect. It takes a long time for the able people to appear and to feel confident enough that they're going to risk their capital and to reposition the economy in a way that is sustainable. So I don't promise an instant fix, because there isn't one. But what I don't want to be is part of a road to serfdom, which is where I think we're going at the moment. And I don't want my digital ID used. I don't want facial recognition cameras. I don't want the banks telling me how I should live my life. You know, I want to be free to make decisions that I think are in the interests of myself, my family, my community. I don't want the state telling me what to do and oppressing me, which is where I think we've got to now.
Oh, I mean, I completely agree. But the issue I have is I don't need to think that I disagree with any of this, because I don't disagree with any of this. My thoughts are more as a strategist, and it's like, right, okay, how do you sell this to people? How do you make people understand that what you're actually offering is an ennobling of society rather than a degradation of society that we're getting at the moment? And I think a lot of people will hear this, and I think they'll be afraid, because a lot of people aren't, there's a large number of people who are not as personally confident as someone like you or I. And so they will withdraw into themselves. And if on the other side you have a Labour government or Zach Polanski offering them comfortable serfdom with no risks, no harms, no dangers, I think it's actually incumbent on us to be able to make an argument that meets them on the level that they're at, to bring them over to our side.
Well, I think people have got a choice to make, Carl. That they're either free and they're not equal, or they're equal and they're not free.
I agree.
So it's that simple. I mean, if you want freedom, you have to accept meritocracy.
I agree, but the issue I'm trying to drive at is, how do you persuade people that actually abandoning the chains is a good thing?
Well, this is the problem, and that's why it's difficult when you've got a lot of people who are sucking off the teeth of the state, which we now have.
Because, I mean, approaching them saying, I offer you hardship. Now, don't get wrong, to me, that sounds good, actually. Right? I like the sound of that.
A hair shirt for a bit.
I completely agree with you. We need a government that is brave enough to admit all the faults and just say, look, we're just going to power through this. It's going to be difficult for the first few years, but we're going to make sure that, you know, your taxes are lower, you have the opportunity, like Germany after World War II, actually, where it's like, you will just have to just knuckle down and work for it.
It's not a difficult formula. You have to just slash the size of the state.
I agree. But
you have to then empower the people.
Of course.
You then hope that I believe that Britain's got the best people historically we've
no
had.
Question.
People fleeing prosecution, whether they were the Jews, whether it was the Protestants, what happened in Europe.
Just look at the accomplishments of England over
the
history.
A lot of them came here. We've achieved. So I've got great belief in the British people. I'm worried at the moment that a lot of people are leaving. And I raised that in Parliament last week. I mean, I don't think Labour have any idea how much money is now in the hands of the baby boomers.
Yeah.
And how many of them can quietly slip out of the country and take their money with them. And that's not going to be good for any of us. So we don't want that.
No. And the young people as well.
A lot of young people are going.
Upwardly mobile people are going to Australia and America.
Well, they're going to. I don't think Australia. I don't think Australia is far behind us in terms of getting it wrong. And you look at Albanese yesterday. I mean, you know, these people come up with utter rubbish, don't they, when these tragedies happen?
Oh yeah.
And you hear all sorts of what I call crocodile tears. But you know, they've played their part in creating an environment where this can happen. They're weak people, and they then come out with all these platitudinous sort of
but the problem nonsense. Is a lot of our people are going. One of my chaps recently went to Australia, and he came back and he said, "There's a large expat community out there of Brits who just find it more pleasant and less intrusive, and we should be following that model." Which is, of course, I think we should.
Look, Perth. I used to do business in Perth in Western Australia. I love it. Mm. I mean, I've often thought, I mean, from a personal comfort and safety point of view, Perth is in the middle of nowhere. It's got the oldest rocks in the world. You have a fantastic risk-taking appetite because that's where you go.
Well, the frontiersman.
To buy gold mining stocks and uranium mining stocks and rare earth stocks. I mean, it's fantastic. I love it. It's my, you know, I love that sort of thing. And it's got virtually no population. So Western Australia,
yeah.
I think it's 8 times the size of the UK or something. And it's got a population of, 3-4 million, tiny. Maybe even less, I something like that. So you've got space, you've got great weather, you've got safety, you've got, as I say, mining. I mean, if people haven't been to Kalgoorlie, Kalgoorlie is just a cultural experience everybody should have, where, you know, it was a prospecting frontiers town, boom and bust, you know, people went out, they worked hard, they played hard. I mean, that's a sort of society I think I like. But so I can see myself living in Perth, but
you can
do
see
I think Australia's got it right politically? Definitely not.
I'm not saying that they're on the right trajectory, but I think that we're far further along the path of statism than they are at the moment. And
but we're leading them.
We are, unfortunately. And the point being, how do we persuade young people that actually, because I mean, young people overwhelmingly vote left wing, even though they're the ones who would be standing to gain the most out of a more libertarian free market society. Because, of course, they're the ones who work hard and have, you know, develop new skills in new areas. So, you know, it's not the old men like us who are developing the new technology.
But I'm encouraged by the Gen Zs, Carl. They're a huge part of our support base.
Oh, yeah.
And they are. In a way, they've been let down by, as you say, these old lags above them who have, if you like, taken opportunity away from them. And I think they can see that. So they want opportunity. They want a life. They want to build, you know, and I'm with them. I understand their anger and they're far more right wing than I am.
I know.
I mean, I'm just a common sense operator. I like things to add up.
Yeah.
These people want their country back, and I don't blame them. So that is a ray of light shining in at the bottom of the pile. And who would have believed it? They've been brought up in these woke schools with the most appalling ideologies, and yet they've rejected all that. And these are now rampantly, arguably capitalistic, logical people who want to fight for something, which is good.
So what do you see happening between now and, I mean, do you even see the election coming in 2029?
Obviously, look, Labour, to your point, I think they're going to get eviscerated at the next election, whatever happens now. So I think they'll hang on for as long as they can, doing as much damage as they can, driving these ridiculous, you know, ideological agendas like getting rid of the jury trial, which I think is terrible. You know, all the stuff they've done, God, you just can't believe how idiotic they are.
Well, it seems very desperate, right?
It's ideological. It has to be.
But it also feels desperate, as in, you know, this feels like they know that this is going to be the last opportunity they'll ever get to do anything like this.
Well, breaking the backbone of Britain for what? Yeah. So you can fund an indolent, bloated state, you know, taxing family businesses, which I've just been talking about, which are the key, the backbone of Britain. Taxing family farms, backbone of Britain. These are the policies we've had in the past have held Britain together, held communities together, held the country together. It's not London, it's the country that matters. That's the body of Britain that's still intact. And what they're doing is now attacking that. And people can see it. So I think they're going to get mullered in the regions, in the agricultural constituencies. They're going to get mullered by people who basically care about their community and their family business. They're going to get mullered by anyone who basically is suffering as a result of what Labour are doing. So,
but they're also
in answer to your question, though, could we have an early election? Well, we could. And I think the thing that will potentially bring on an early election will make things even worse for Labour, which is going to be a collapsing economy, right?
Yeah.
So I think our economy, I don't understand economically how sterling is holding up. I just don't get it. So something very odd going on there, whether the central banks are manipulating the currency. I think, you know, we've got the stage now where you've got this schism between the consuming nations, which are us, and the producing nations, which are largely Asia and China. And while those countries that are doing all the work are happy to accept our paper, everything works fine. But the minute they say, well, hang on a sec, why are we accepting this piece of bog roll for all of this enterprise that we've done? Then you've got a problem. And you are beginning to see signs of it. So I was reading an article the other day, China is backing the yuan with gold.
Right? Oh, really?
Yeah. And you are starting to see, I think, a shift from what I call the consuming currencies to the producing currencies. And you've got, obviously, the emergence of the BRICS. You've got you know, the Russia, the India, the China. So you've got these countries that are, I think, beginning to see. So I've always said credit is suspicion asleep. Tucker Carlson liked that. And I think the suspicion is growing. So I think the suspicion between the consumers and the producers is actually getting to the stage where you could see some form of currency carnage. I think that's what we're heading for. So when that happens, countries like us who are relying on a strong currency, even though we haven't got a strong economy, then you suffer.
And you think that might happen before 2039?
But naturally, then, if you believe in floating currencies, which I do, that's why I didn't like the euro, sterling will come down, and then you start to get capital formation because our economy starts to become competitive again.
Right.
And Jimmy Goldsmith talked about this in 1945. He was absolutely spot on. He said, what are we doing? We're outsourcing all of our knowledge, all of our skill sets, all of our investment, we're outsourcing it to different countries. And what we're doing is laying the seeds of our own destruction.
Correct.
And that's what's happened. So at the moment, gold's going up. That tells you something. Precious metals are flying. Suspicion is growing. And that could destroy the British economy. And then Labour are finished because they will not be able to keep this going. They've taxed the private sector into oblivion. They're funding a bloated state that's dishonest now. As I've just said to you, they don't bother with audited accounts. If you or I don't bother with audited accounts, we end up being banned from being a director or even worse, in prison. And if you don't pay your taxes, you know, I was talking at the committee last week and I said, so can you define, they were talking about missing data. I said, so what do you mean by missing data? Oh, well, this is data that hasn't been made available. I said, well, if I tell HMRC that I'm terribly sorry, I've got a lot of missing data and I therefore don't know how much money I've made. They say to me, well, I'm terribly sorry. We think you've made this much. Therefore, you must pay this much.
Yes.
But that doesn't happen to the state. So people need to understand the state is their enemy. Yep. it's working against us all. What? How long would people like Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves, Angela Rayner, you know, Bridget Phillipson, Powell, how long would these people all survive in a real capitalist society?
Well, the answer is no time at all, which is why they don't want it.
So they'd be cleaning people's shoes, Carl.
Yes.
Because they are not able people.
No. So, but so do you think this is going to happen before 2029? Is that what you're saying?
I think it could happen at any time. I don't know. I am amazed because I've, you know, we've laid people off. Other people are laying people off. Look at the unemployment figures. They're going up.
Mm.
And with what she's done with national insurance, she's put a tax on employment.
Oh, it's insane.
So it's going to affect working people.
Yes.
And it's going to affect the growth in the economy. You're already seeing that. The economy is beginning to actually slow down quite fast.
Well, there was a recession.
We're technically about to enter a recession. So I think Christmas is here, so everybody concentrates on Christmas, but they spend... they get paid early in December.
Yeah.
Then suddenly they don't have any money to see themselves through January to get to the paycheck. So I think we're in a vicious circle downwards. And I think that, so in answer to your question, they won't go to the country unless they have to.
Mm.
The one thing I think could force them to the country is if we do get an economic collapse. And I can't see how we can call ourselves a functioning, growing economy when we spend all our money on welfare.
Well, we're not.
It's bizarre.
I mean, the way the Labour government taxes...
Welfare and state pensions.
It's just predatory, though. It's just a predatory government. It's genuinely... I remember reading a book about fascist economics years ago called Vampire Economy, and it was done by a German communist economist in the 40s. Who'd lived through Nazi Germany. And he said, look, the fascist government just becomes like a vampire on the state, on the country, draining as much out of it as it can for its own purposes.
Isn't that what we're seeing now here?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like this, the
book I always liked was, I think we talked about this, is The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism by Max Weber.
Right.
Where I think you need honesty to build... It's like building a bank. You know, bankers took a generation to build their bank, and it took a week to destroy the bank, a week of recklessness or dishonesty.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, a Protestant ethic, and if you look at a lot of the success of the, you know, those businesses, you know, in Norfolk in particular, where you had the Quakers and, you know, the honest people who actually trusted each other and could trust each other, their businesses flourished. The Cadbury's, the Roundtree's, you know, all those sort of, the Barclays Bank was all based on a lot of landowners from Norfolk and Essex. So I think our country's become dishonest, and in a dishonest society, you need to be a good liar, a bit like the communists.
Yeah.
So I don't like that. I like people who are upfront and honest and say what they think, even if you don't agree with them. And that way you get at the truth. So I think we're in dangerous times. I think we're in dishonest times. I think we're in times where the state is acting in its own interests, not in the interests of the people it's supposed to be serving. And the British people need to stand up to it, because if they don't, they're going to lose their freedom.
So let's finish with what's next for Restore Britain. So I understand that you're engaging. The rape gang inquiry is ongoing. You've just
released... The rape gang inquiry, we are going to continue with.
Yeah.
So when the government 6 months ago announced the statutory inquiry, which I think was in response to what we were doing.
It absolutely was, yeah.
I was told, oh, I could stand down. We're not standing down, because we know that this is not something that any of the organs of the establishment want to come out. And the more we've been doing our work, the more vile and the more systemically embedded it is in our across the country.
And
not just a few little places.
The thing is, we know that they don't want it because they all voted against it.
Right. So we start sending out invitations to people to our hearing, which is going to be in the first 2 weeks of February.
Great.
What happens? They appoint a Labour peer to be the chairman of their inquiry, right? And they tell us the timetable for their inquiry means that no truth will come out till 28. So all you need is a little slip in the timetable, and guess what? Won't come out before the next election. So I offered our help in the House, and I got told, if you've got any information, we are the statutory inquiry, give it to us. So we're going to carry on. We've got 2 weeks of hearings. We've got a very able barrister who's going to hear it all. He's then going to produce a report, hopefully by April, end of March, April, depending on how long it takes him. And it's going to be really hard hitting. So we are going to be fulfilling what 20,000 people donated to.
Yeah.
We're going to deliver them a report that shows how widespread this vileness was. And we are going to then look at the people who failed to look after those people they're supposed to be looking after.
I think we may well then,
Carl, indulge in some private prosecutions, because the state won't do it. So somebody's got to do it. And if we don't have enough money left, bearing in mind we only raised 600,000, the J report costs 186 million of taxpayers' money. But I think 20,000 people cared about this. We had some tiny donations from people who probably couldn't afford it, but they care. They care more than the Labour government, who should be dealing with this.
Well, I think the
Jess Phillips smirks in Parliament when we talk about this. It's a joke.
I know. I think a lot of people are interested in seeing the connections between the Labour government, the councils, the police, and the gangs. Because I think that there probably is a lot of connective tissue between them, which is, I think, why the Labour government has been so reticent to do anything about it. I think they know they're complicit.
I've just got to give credit to my entire team, particularly led by Sammy Woodhouse, who was herself a victim. And I think, she is driven to bring this out. And we can tell you it's still happening in London.
Oh, yeah.
Sadiq Khan can bob and weave, but the fact of the matter is, this is still going on today.
Yeah.
It's slightly changed in the way in which it's perpetrated, but it's still happening. And I don't think this country can move on till we've exposed this to, as I call, the sanity of sunlight. And we have effectively allowed people to understand why it happened, how it happened, and how so many people failed in their duty to actually bring those people who were doing it to book. Meanwhile, they're happy to send Lucy Conley to prison for a social media post, which is a joke.
Yeah. What else is Restore Britain?
So Restore, look, we've got a great young team.
I know.
And you know a lot of them.
I do.
They are, I think, entirely... I like to devolve power to them, and they do a great job in getting on with it. So we are driving our membership. That's growing. We've had some big donations. We are producing research like we did on mass deportation. We've got another one that's about to come through. So this is proper research. And I think what we're trying to do is unify common sense thought. And the reason I set up a movement, because I didn't want to set up another party and be divisive. And so far it's worked. The Tories have put me on the Public Accounts Committee, credit to them. I get on very well with all the Tories. I think some very good young Tories. I talked to Ben Habib, who I think shares a lot of what we want to achieve, although his view was he wanted a party. The fact he called it Advance UK, which I, as I've told you before, I think sounds like a toothpaste brand rather than a party. That's up to him. But I like Ben very much, and I talked to him. I think he's a good man. He shares our broad sentiments, and I think we should all be supporting each other.
I agree.
So I think the Reform membership are good people. I don't think the Reform leadership are good people, because they tried to put me in prison for whatever reason.
And notice how they've never walked that back at all. Rupert Lowe, he tried to murder me and he has dementia, and nothing came
of it. Well, people who were, that's palpable rubbish.
Well, I know, but the point is, it's palpable rubbish.
Nigel even said he had meetings with me the other day, apparently, which had been in a Spectator article, where I you couldn't be in the room with me for more than 3 minutes, and I lost my temper. I mean, I have never lost my temper in front of Nigel, and it is quite extraordinary that he peddles such rubbish. I can only conclude that he's worried about the fact that we are growing the common sense thought and trying to unite rather than divide. And I, you know, I don't want to see a divided right or divided common sense wing of Britain let in a Polanski, you know, Lib Dem, Labour coalition, because that really would be time to up stumps and move on and leave this place to fester in its own rotting sewage. So I look, we've got to fight for it now. I've always said publicly we must achieve this by 29. We have to start the process now, which I think we've already done. And we have to be active until then. And then I don't know how the cards are going to fall.
Right. So there isn't a particular plan to enter into a particular party or anything like that?
We have to have a body which understands what needs to be done and doesn't have any legacy issues which are going to hold us back.
Okay.
So whichever entity offers us that opportunity is the entity to restore Britain with.
Okay. Finally, let me ask you about Great Yarmouth First.
Yes.
Because that was a surprising success.
Well, Great Yarmouth First, the genesis of that, Carl, was I have a business forum in Great Yarmouth every 3 months where we have about 80 or 90 people come to talk to us. And I like to understand from the local community what they want to see change. So at each of these meetings, we talk about, you know, what's happening with the local council, what's happening really across Great Yarmouth. And a lot of them have got much, much better intelligence than I've got because they're all working within the community. And it's encouraging a lot of Great Yarmouth businesses do work together to try and support each other, which I like very much. So at the meeting, I said, we've got three opportunities with regard to the upcoming county council elections, which, again, Labour could try and cancel them still. They've cancelled the mayoral elections, which I think is a disgrace, and they're going to try, and I think they're probably going to, they could try, but I think there'd be an outcry now. I mean, I spoke strongly in Parliament against it. It would be completely undemocratic, and I don't think the British people would like it, so I hope they don't try.
Well, it'd be the third time, wouldn't it, that they'd cancel elections?
I said we can do three things. We can either sit it out, we can support the Tories, or we can set up Great Yarmouth First. What do you want to do? Unanimous vote to set up Great Yarmouth First. So I said, well, look, I haven't got a lot of bandwidth to do this stuff. I'm the chairman.
Yep.
I said, I'll seed it with my first, with a month's salary, which I did. But then it's up to you because you've got to fight for your own local community. And if you believe in your local community and you fight for it, you're probably going to win all the seats there. And then when they do set up this homunculus of what I call a unitary sort of authority, which is going to amalgamate lots of bits of shit together, and you end up with one big bit of shit, in my view, which doesn't reflect local democracy. I actually quite like the borough council and the county council. I think it brings a sort of local flavour to it. So Great Yarmouth will have 9 seats on the county council if the elections go ahead next May. And then when this unitary nonsense, which I think is Angela Rayner's sort of...
centralisation bid.
Play thing, more centralisation, more central planning, less accountability, more oppression, you know, more sort of serfdom for the people.
More remote governance.
That's it. That's it. So it's terrible. But at least Great Yarmouth will then have 9 seats on whatever comes out of the sausage machine. We don't know what that's going to be yet.
But I found it very interesting.
And it could be the model across the country if other people.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
If other people decide to take back their control of their destiny, I like that. That's what they should do.
That's what I was thinking because the fact that instantly it was polling at 44% in the constituency.
We polled 44%. Yeah,
that's pretty incredible.
Their party. It's their party. Why wouldn't they vote for it?
Why wouldn't you vote for it? And it does suggest a model for the future where you actually have a coalition of independent parties that are interested in actually representing their own constituency. So you can have Oxford first, Swindon first, Great Yarmouth first, Clacton first. You know, you can have all of these rather than the sort of monolithic national parties.
Well, isn't it nice to think the Great Yarmouth, the Hanseatic League port, which it is,
could lead the way
in redemocratizizing Britain. I think it's rather good.
I think it's spectacular.
The bedrock of British people on the coastal communities have been let down by all parties post-war, leading the charge to get their democracy back. That would be rich irony, wouldn't it? I think it'd be good.
It would be wonderful. But this is the thing. It's actually quite inspirational how so many people in Great Yarmouth have recognized, oh, this is a good idea for us. And if they are leading the charge and set an example to the rest of us.
All I can tell you, Carl, is that we've had some leaflets printed and they are fired up.
Really?
And I think, when local people are fired up about local things, that's how you get change.
Very interesting. Well, thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure. The voice just about held out.
Yeah, just about. And good luck with Great Yarmouth First. I think it's genuinely the most exciting thing that's happened in British politics in a long time, actually.
Hopefully other people, do you think they'll follow? Hopefully they will.
Hopefully. I mean, what are they going to lose? Like, what do they stand to lose?
It's so boring, all this internecine warfare between Labour, the Lib Dems.
I'm just tired of it.
The Tories and the Greens.
Yeah. And I don't care about any of them. No. And I don't think any of them are here to help anyone. And, I mean, ultimately, none of them are going to get the drains unclogged. No. None of them are going to get the potholes filled.
No.
None of them are going to get my taxes down. You know, what do you stand to lose? Absolutely nothing.
Anyway. Some passion. I think it'll bring some passion into local politics.
Yeah,
what we want.
Thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure.